lives. I was fine with that. It's what I wanted. It's what I still want. Why do you find that so hard to believe?
He looks at her for a moment too long, and she tries to imagine him all dressed in white as a tithe. She could like that boy, still pure and untainted. But the kid before her now is a different person.
Sorry,
she says, not sorry at all.
I guess I failed deprogramming school.
She turns her back to him and waits a few moments, knowing he's just standing there. Then turns again, only to find that he's not. He has left, closing the door so quietly she didn't hear. 27. Lev. Lev sits in on yet another meeting of the tithe rescue staff. He doesn't know why they include him. Kavanaugh never listens to what he says. These meetings truly make him feel like a mascot, a favorite pet. This time, however, he's determined to make them listen. Even before they begin, Lev speaks loudly enough to get everyone's attention, stealing the floor from Kavanaugh before he has the chance to take it.
"Why is the portrait of me back in the dining hall?" he asks. "It was already vandalized once. Why put it back?"
The question quiets everyone down and brings the room to order.
"I ordered it restored and returned," says Kavanaugh. "The comfort and focus it provides the ex-tithes is invaluable."
"I agree," says one of the teachers. "I think it draws their focus toward the positive."
Then she punctuates her remark with a brown-nosing nod toward Kavanaugh.
"I, for one, like it and approve."
"Well, I don't like it, and I don't approve,"
Lev tells them, for the first time voicing his feelings out loud.
"I shouldn't be some sort of God thing. I shouldn't be put on a pedestal. I'm not and never have been this image you're trying to make me."
There's silence around the room as everyone waits to see how Kavanaugh will react. He takes his time and finally says,
"We all have our jobs here. Yours is very clear and very simple. To be an example for the other ex-tithes to follow. Have you noticed kids have been letting their hair grow? At first I thought your hair would be off-putting, but now they're modeling themselves on you. It's what they need at this juncture."
"I'm not a role model,"
Lev yells. He stands up, not even realizing he's come to his feet.
"I was a clapper, a terrorist. I made awful decisions."
But Kavanaugh remains calm.
"It's your good decisions we care about. Now sit down and let us get on with this meeting."
Lev looks around the table, but sees no support. If anything, he sees them all tallying this outburst as one of his bad decisions, best forgotten. He boils with the same kind of anger that once turned him into a clapper, but he bites it back, sits down, and remains silent for the rest of the meeting. It's only as the meeting breaks up that Kavanaugh takes his hand, not to shake it, but to flip it over and scrutinize his fingers, or, more specifically, to look under his fingernails.
"Best clean those a little better, Lev,"
he says.
"Spray paint comes out with turpentine, I think."
28. Risa. Risa does not have an Easter social. She can't even be sure which day is Easter. She's lost track of the days. In fact, she can't even be sure where she is. At first, she's held by the juvenile authority in Tucson, then transferred in a windowless armored vehicle to another detention facility about 2 hours away, in Phoenix, she presumes. Here is where they send in interrogators to ask her questions.
"How many kids are in the graveyard?"
"A bunch."
"Who sent your supplies?"
"George Washington. Oh, or is it Abraham Lincoln? I forget."
"How often do you receive new arrivals?"
"About as often as you beat your wife."
The interrogators are infuriated by her lack of cooperation, but she has no intention of telling them anything useful. Besides, she knows they're asking her questions they already know the answers to. The questions are merely tests to see whether she'll tell the truth or lie. She doesn't do either. Instead, she makes a mockery of each interrogation.
"Your cooperation might make things easier on you,"
they tell her.
"I don't want things easy," she responds. "I've had a hard life. I'd rather stick with what's familiar."
They let her go hungry, but don't let her starve. They tell her they have Elvis Robert Mullard in custody, and they're cutting him a deal for information. But she knows they're lying, because if they had him, they'd know it's not Mullard at all, but Connor. This is how it goes for 2 weeks. Then one day in walks a juvie cop. He aims a gun at her and unceremoniously tranks her, not in the leg where it would hurt the least, but right in the chest where it stings until she loses consciousness. She awakes in a different cell, a little newer and larger perhaps, but still a cell. She has no idea where she has been transported this time or why. This new cell is not at all designed for a paraplegic, and her captors have offered no help since she arrived. Not that she'd accept it if they did, but it's as if they want her to struggle over the lip of the bathroom threshold or onto her bed, which is abnormally high, just enough to make getting into it an ordeal. She suffers a week of food brought in by a silent guard in a rent-a-cop uniform. She knows she's no longer in the hands of the juvenile authority, but who her new captors are is a mystery. These new jailers ask no questions, and that concerns her the same way that Connor is always concerned by the fact that the graveyard has never been taken out. Are they so unimportant in the grand scheme of things that the juvenile authority won't even torture her to get the information they want? Have they been deluding themselves into thinking they're making a difference? All this time, she's forced out thoughts of Connor, because it simply hurt too much to think about him. How horrified he must have been when she turned herself in. Horrified and stunned. Well, fine. Let him be. He'll get over it. She did it for him just as much as she did it for the injured boy, because as painful as it is to admit, Risa knows she had become just a distraction to Connor. If he's truly going to lead those kids in the graveyard like the Admiral did, he can't be giving Risa leg massages and worrying whether her emotional needs are being met. Maybe he does love her, but it's obvious there's no room in his life at this moment to pay it any more than lip service. Risa has no idea what her future holds now. All she knows is that she must focus on that future and not on Connor, no matter how much that hurts. A few days later, Risa finally has an actual visitor, a well-dressed woman with an air of authority.
"Good morning, Risa. It's a pleasure to finally meet the girl behind the hullabaloo."
Risa immediately decides that anyone who uses the word hullabaloo cannot be her friend. The woman sits down in the single chair in the cell. It's a chair that has never been used, because it's not exactly designed for a paraplegic. In fact, it seems specifically designed not to be accessible to Risa, like most everything else in her cell.
"I trust they've been treating you well?"
"I haven't been treated at all. I've been ignored."
"You haven't been ignored," the woman tells her. "You've just been allowed some time to settle, some time alone to think."
Somehow I doubt I've ever been alone. Risa throws a glance to a large wall mirror, through which she can occasionally see shadows.
"So, am I some sort of political prisoner?"
she asks, getting right to the point.
"If you're not going to torture me, do you just plan to leave me here to rot? Or maybe you're selling me to a parts pirate, at least the parts that work."
"None of those things," says the woman.
"I'm here to help you, and you, my dear, are going to help us."
"I doubt that." Risa rolls away, although she can't roll very far. The woman doesn't get up from her chair. She doesn't even move. She just sits there, comfortably. Risa wanted to be in control of this situation, but this woman keeps control with her voice alone.
"My name is Roberta. I represent an organization called Proactive Citizenry. Our purpose, among other things, is to do good in this world. We seek to advance the causes of both science and freedom, as well as to provide a sense of spiritual enlightenment."
"And what does that have to do with me?" Roberta smiles and pauses a moment, holding her smile before she speaks.
"I'm going to have the charges against you dropped, Risa. But more importantly, I'm going to get you out of that wheelchair and give you a new spine."
Risa turns to her, filled with more mixed emotions than she can sort right now.
"No, you will not. It's my right to refuse the spine of an unwind."
"Yes, it is,"
Roberta says, way too calmly.
"However, I firmly believe you will change your mind."
Risa crosses her arms, her belief more firm than Roberta's that she won't. She's given the silent treatment again. But they must be getting impatient, because it's only for 2 days this time, instead of a week. Roberta returns and sits once more in the chair designed for people who can walk. This time she has a folder with her, although Risa can't see what's inside.
"Have you given any thought to my offer?"
Roberta asks her.
"I don't need to. I already gave you my answer."
"It's very noble to stand on principle and refuse an unwound spine," Roberta says. "It does, however, represent a wrongful mindset that is neither productive nor adaptive. It's backward, actually, and it makes you part of the problem."
"I plan to keep my wrongful mindset, as well as my wheelchair."
"Very well. I won't deny you your choice."
Roberta shifts in her chair, perhaps a little irritated, or maybe just in anticipation.
"There's someone I'd like you to meet."
Then she stands and opens the door. Risa knows that whoever it is has been waiting in the other room, watching through the one-way mirror.
"You can come in now,"
Roberta says cheerfully. A boy steps in cautiously. He seems 16 or so. He has multicolored skin and multicolored streaks in his hair. At first, she assumes it's some sort of extreme body modification, but she quickly realizes it's more than that. There is something profoundly wrong about him.
"Hi,"
he says, and smiles tentatively with perfect teeth.
"I'm Cam. I've been looking forward to meeting you, Risa."
Risa backs away, her wheelchair bumping the wall. Now it strikes her exactly what she's seeing, exactly why this boy seems so off. She has seen a news report about this creation. Her flesh starts to crawl. If it could, it would crawl right through the air vents to escape what she's seeing.
"Get that thing away from me! It's disgusting! Get it away!"
His expression mirrors Risa's horror. He backs away and hits the wall as well.
"It's all right, Cam," Roberta says. "You know, people always have to get used to you, and she will."
Roberta offers him the chair, but suddenly Cam doesn't want to be there. He wants to escape just as much as Risa does. Risa looks to Roberta so she doesn't have to look at Cam.
"I said get it out of here."
"I am not an it,"
Cam insists. Risa shakes her head.
"Yes, you are."
She still won't look directly at him.
"Now get it out of here, or I swear I will rip every stolen part out of its body with my bare hands."
She tries not to catch his gaze, but she can't stop herself. The thing has begun to cry tears from someone else's stolen tear ducts, and it just makes her angry.
"Dagger, plunge deep," he says.
Risa has no idea what he's talking about, but doesn't really care.
"Get it out of my sight,"
she yells at Roberta.
"And if you have any decency in you at all, you'll kill it."
Roberta looks at her sternly and then turns to Cam.
"You can go, Cam. Wait outside for me."
Cam quickly, awkwardly leaves, and Roberta closes the door. Now she's fuming. If Risa can take anything positive out of this, it's that she's gotten the better of Roberta.
"You're a cruel girl,"
Roberta says.
"And you're a monster to create a thing like that.
History will be the judge of who we are and what we've done."
And then she puts a piece of paper down on the table.
"This is a consent form. Sign it and you can have a new working spine by the end of the week."
Risa picks it up, tears it to shreds, and throws the pieces in the air. Roberta must have been expecting this, because she instantly pulls out a second consent form from her folder and slaps it down on the table.
"You will be healed, and you will make up to Cam for how badly you've treated him today."
"Not in this life or any other."
Roberta smiles like she knows something Risa doesn't.
"Well then, here's hoping you have a sudden change of heart."
Then she exits the room, leaving the pen and the consent form on the table. Risa looks at the consent form long after Roberta has gone. She knows she won't sign it, but the fact that they want her to intrigues her. Why is it so important to them that her broken body be repaired? There's only one answer to that. For some reason, Risa is much more important than she ever dreamed she was. Important to both sides. 29. Cam. He sits in the observation room. He's been there more often than he'd like to admit, spying on Risa. Although when it's officially allowed through a one-way mirror, it's not called spying. It's called surveillance. On the other side of the glass, Risa stares at the contract Roberta put before her. Her face is stony, her jaw clenched. Finally, she picks up the page, then folds it into a paper airplane and throws it at the mirror. Cam jolts in spite of himself. He knows she can't see him, but still she looks into the mirror at almost the right spot to make eye contact. For a moment, Cam feels like she can see not only through the glass, but through him as well, and he has to look away. He hates the fact that she hates him. He should have expected it, but still, her words hurt him deeply and make him want to hurt her back. But no, that's just the reaction of the various unwinds in his head. Kids who would lash out at the slightest provocation. He won't give in to those impulses. There are enough sensible parts of him to balance things and allow him to control those parts that threaten to disturb the peace. He reminds himself that, as Roberta has said, he is the new paradigm, the new model of what humanity could and should be. The world will get used to him, and in time, revere him, and so will Risa. Roberta comes into the room behind him and speaks quietly.
There's no point staying here.
Jericho, he says. She's a wall, but she'll crumble. I know she will.
Roberta smiles at him.
I have no doubt that you'll win her over. In fact, I suspect she'll change her mind sooner than you think.
Cam tries to read between the lines of her smile, but she reveals nothing.
Cat that ate the canary. I don't like when you keep secrets.
No secret, Roberta tells him. Just an undying faith in human nature. Now come, it's almost time for your photo shoot.
Cam sighs.
Another one?
Would you prefer a press conference?
A sharp stick in the eye? No, thank you.
Cam has to admit that this new approach to the media is far better than press conferences and interviews. Roberta and her friends at Proactive Citizenry have cooked up a first-class advertising campaign. Billboards, print ads, digital, the works. All just photos, but even so, the ads are powerful. The first round of ads will feature extreme close-ups of various parts of him. An eye, streaks of his multicolored hair, the starburst of flesh tones on his forehead. Each image will be accompanied by a pithy but enigmatic caption like, "The time has come," or "The brilliant tomorrow," with no other clue as to what's being advertised. Then, when public curiosity is piqued, they move to phase two, where the ads will feature his face, his body, and finally his whole self.
"We'll create a mystique around you," Roberta told him. "Play into their puerile fascination with the exotic until they're chomping at the bit to see more."
"Striptease,"
Cam had said.
"An elevated version of the same concept, I suppose," Roberta admitted. "Once the ad campaign has rolled out, you will enter the public eye not as an oddity, but as a celebrity. And when you finally deign to do interviews, it will be on our terms."
"My terms,"
Cam corrected.
"Yes, of course. Your terms."
Now, as Cam watches Risa through the one-way glass, he wonders what could possibly make her live by his terms, too. Roberta has told him that he can have anything he desires. But what if the thing he desires most is Risa choosing to be with him of her own free will?
"Cam, please, come now or we'll be late."
Cam stands, but before he leaves, he spares one last glance through the mirror at Risa, who has struggled onto her bed. Now she lies stretched out on her back, looking morosely at the ceiling. Then she closes her eyes.
"The eternally sleeping princess,"
thinks Cam.
but I shall free you from those poison brambles that surround your heart. And then you will have no choice but to love me.
30. Nelson. The juvie cop turned parts pirate makes a side trip to check one of his most successful traps. It is, however, in an unfortunate location. Unfortunate because it's in a field that floods during storms. Nothing's more irritating than a drowned AWOL, except maybe disposing of one. He would rather continue searching for safe houses, with hopes of finding Connor Lassiter in one of them. But with major storms projected throughout the Midwest, checking this particular trap is worth the effort. The trap is a piece of drainage pipe, a concrete cylinder 5 feet high and 20 feet long, lying in a fallow field that no one has farmed for years. Half a dozen such pipes rest in the field, surrounded by weeds, all abandoned when some public works project got canceled. It's a nice hiding spot for runaway unwinds, and in fact, one of the tunnel segments has a store of canned food right in the middle. The inside surface of that same cylinder, however, is painted with superadhesive resin that sticks to clothes and flesh with such tenacity that anyone caught in the pipe might as well be nailed to the concrete. It tickles Nelson that he can catch unwinds the way other people catch roaches. Sure enough, there's a kid stuck in the pipe.
"Hobby!"
the boy shouts, kind of like the fly caught in the spider web.
"Hobby, please!"
The kid is scrawny and acne-ridden, with crooked teeth yellowed from chewing tobacco or just bad genetics. Either way, he's not a prime specimen, and won't fetch much on the black market. His hair is plastered with glue, although Nelson suspects it doesn't look much better clean.
"My God! What happened to you?"
Nelson says, feigning concern.
"It's like glue or something. I can't get out."
"Okay," Nelson says. "I think I can get you out of there. I have some adhesive remover in the van."
Actually, he already has it with him. He pretends to jog away and jog back, then soaks a foul-smelling rag with the fluid, climbs into the tunnel, and begins dabbing the kid's clothes and skin. Bit by bit, the boy comes free from the adhesive.
"Thanks, mister,"
says the kid.
"Thanks a lot."
Nelson climbs out and waits at the mouth of the tunnel as the gooey, glue-covered kid slides himself out, just as nasty as a baby being born. Then, as he comes into the light of day, something finally occurs to this dim bulb.
"Hey! Wait a second. Why would someone have that there adhesive remover stuff unless..."
Nelson doesn't give him the chance to finish his thought. He grabs the boy, wrenches his arms behind his back, and tugs a plastic cable tie around his wrists. Then Nelson pushes him to the ground and pricks him with the DNA reader.
"William Yachts,"
Nelson announces, and the kid groans.
"AWOL for 4 days. Not too good at hiding, are you?"
"You ain't taking me in!"
Yachts screams.
"You ain't taking me in!"
"You're right, I'm not,"
Nelson tells him.
"You're not going in. You're going up, as in up on the black market auction block, ka-ching!"
The kid seems to go both pale and red in the face at the same time, making him all blotchy. Nelson surprises him with a hypodermic. Not tranks, though.
"Antibiotics,"
he tells the boy.
"Clean out whatever diseases crawled into your system while you're in that pipe. Even the ones that were there before. Most of them, anyway."
"Please, mister, you don't gotta do this. Please!"
Nelson kneels down and takes a good look at him.
"I'll tell you what,"
he says.
"I like your eyes, so I'll make you a deal."
He cuts the cable tie and offers the same deal he always offers. A countdown. A chance to run. These AWOLs never realize that the game is rigged. It never occurs to them that Nelson can count as fast as he chooses, and they don't know that he's a very, very good shot. This boy, like all the others, thinks he'll be the one to escape. He takes off, tripping in the field and picking himself up while Nelson counts. He nears the road as Nelson gets to 8 and raises his gun.
9!
He has a clear target, the clothing logo on the kid's back.
10!
Then Nelson lowers the gun and doesn't fire. Instead, he watches as the kid races across the road, nearly getting hit by a car. But the car swerves around him. The kid then disappears into the woods. Nelson applauds his own restraint. It would have been so easy to take the kid down, but he has other plans for this AWOL. The injection he gave the kid wasn't an antibiotic at all, but a delivery system for a microscopic tracking chip, the kind they use to monitor the populations of endangered species. This is the fourth AWOL Nelson has tagged and released into the wild since his new mission began. With any luck, they'll get picked up by the Resistance and give him a clear path to the AWOL sanctuary where Connor Lassiter is holed up. But in the meantime, there are plenty of local leads to follow up on. Nelson smiles. It's good to have a goal, something joyful to look forward to.
31. Miracolina. Miracolina endures her captivity and deprogramming at the hands of the anti-divisional resistance for weeks, but never surrenders her core. She never gives in to the things they try to teach her. Oh, she's learned to function within their little world of ex-tithes, doing what's expected, if only so they'll leave her alone. More tithes are brought in. Others are placed with families and given new identities. There's no such plan for Miracolina. Even semi-cooperative, she's still too much of a risk. They have no idea, however, what she's really planning. Miracolina considers herself up for any challenge. While she is a tithe, she has not lived the same sheltered life as most other tithes, and although she's not a girl from the hard streets, she considers herself street smart and world savvy. Escaping from the velvet-gloved fist of the Resistance will be a challenge, but not an insurmountable one. Early on, Lev personally warned her of the futility of an escape attempt.
"There are sharpshooters with trank rifles everywhere," he said, making it sound hopeless.
Yet every bit of information helps her, because Lev let it slip that although there's a fence, it isn't electrified. Good to know. She explores every corner of the huge mansion to which she has access, paying special attention to the many unused, dilapidated rooms and corridors too far gone to be restored. Most of the windows are boarded over, and all the doors to the outside are locked. But the more forgotten an area is, the less reliable those locks will be, and a padlock hasp is only as good as the wood it's screwed into, such as the lock on the garden door, which has an unpleasant termite infestation. Once she finds the door, she files the information away for future reference. The ex-tithe's meals are usually served on chipped china that must have been part of the Kavanaugh collection in better days. But on Sundays, the finest stuff is brought out, including silver platters just large enough to fit beneath her shirt, like armor. Again, she files the information away for future reference. Now all she needs is a diversion, not just inside the mansion, but outside as well. Unfortunately, that's not something she can create, so she bides her time, confident that an opportunity will present itself. An opportunity such as a tornado watch on a Sunday night. The wind is already picking up at dinner time. Talk of the coming storm rumbles throughout the crowd of kids. Some are scared, some are excited. Lev is notably absent. Maybe he's left to avoid the storm, whisked away by his protectors to a place of greater safety. When the meal is over, Miracolina clears her plate, taking with her a couple of silver serving platters, presumably to bring to the kitchen.
"You don't have to do that, Miracolina," says one of her teachers.
"It's okay. I don't mind,"
she says with a smile, and the teacher smiles back, glad to see her finally settling in. The storm hits like spring storms do, a warning wind, then a deluge like heaven itself is ruptured. Rain pours through holes in the roof into the areas that have yet to be repaired. The ballroom, where Miracolina was first greeted by Lev, is at least an inch deep with water. Pans set up beneath leaks in bedrooms fill and must be dumped. It's like bailing out a sinking ship. The Weather Channel shows a grid of Michigan counties blinking angry red with tornado alerts.
"Don't worry," says one of the teachers. There's a storm cellar if they call a tornado alert in our area.
Which they do, at exactly 8:43. Immediately the staff begins rounding up the kids. With lightning striking and agitated kids, it's hard to keep track of everyone. That's when Miracolina slips away with several serving platters and disappears down a side passage, hurrying toward the termite-ridden door. Standing in front of the door, she shoves the large platters under her shirt, both front and back. They're cold and uncomfortable, but very necessary. She slips two smaller platters down the back of her sweatpants, turning them into protectors for her rear. She waits for a powerful burst of lightning to fill the sky in uneven, strobing flashes, and the moment the thunder rolls in a few seconds later, she smashes the door with her shoulder. It gives on the second attempt, while the thunder is still rolling, hiding the sound of the door as it bursts open. There is still the remains of a path left in the middle of the ruined garden. She races down the path, immediately drenched and almost blinded by rain. Then she races from the garden into the weedy clearing that leads to the woods, in clear view of any sharpshooter, and she wonders if infrared lenses can see through sheets of rain. She knows metal is a conductor of electricity, and in the back of her mind she fears that the lightning might seek her out. But she has to believe that won't happen. She has to believe that God has brought this storm for her, so she can escape. So she can do what she was meant to do. And if she does get struck by lightning, well, that would be a sign from above too, wouldn't it? So she says a silent prayer.
Lord, if what I'm doing is wrong, then by all means strike me down. Otherwise, set me free.
32. Lev. A lightning strike is provided. Not one to strike Miracolina down, but to illuminate her for all to see, or at least for anyone who happens to be looking. Most everyone is already in or en route to the storm cellar, which may or may not stand the force of a tornado, considering how old it is. Lev, however, who has always loved storms, and actually has a window in his room to view it, is slow to leave. He stalls, taking a few moments to watch the raw violence of nature. A gust of wind rattles the old windows, almost enough to break them, and a particularly long flash of lightning hits. In that flash, he sees someone running across the grass and into the woods. It's only a brief glimpse, but it's enough for him to know exactly who it is, even if he can't see her face. 33. Miracolina. She doesn't hear the first rifle fire, but she feels the trank dart as it hits the silver platter strapped to her back. Its barbed tip caught in the fabric of her sweatshirt. She doesn't know where the shooter is, except that he's behind her. She was hoping that the sharpshooters had left their stations to shelter from the storm, but at least one, maybe more, are still on the lookout, perhaps knowing that a storm like this is a clear flight opportunity for any kids not yet deprogrammed. Another dart whizzes past her, inches away, and from a different direction. There's more than one shooter still in place. She knows they're going after her body because they wouldn't risk a shot to the head, so she pulls in her arms, making herself a smaller target. Another dart hits one of the smaller platters covering her rear. She almost didn't put those there because they hampered her ability to run. Now she's glad she did. This time the dart doesn't stick, it just bounces free. In a moment she's in the woods, with the trees whipping around her. If there are any sharpshooters here in the woods, she would be really surprised. More than likely the shots came from the mansion itself. She doubts even the most dedicated snipers would hold their positions in the woods in the middle of a tornado threat. She has no idea in what direction she's running, but any direction is the right one if it's away from the mansion. She knows that eventually she'll come to a fence. She can only hope that it's not too high to climb. The only view ahead of her comes from freeze-frame glimpses in flashes of lightning. Her clothes are torn and her face scratched by whipping branches. She stumbles into mud but picks herself up and continues. Then, in a flash of light, she sees a chain-link fence up ahead. It's about 8 feet high, not too hard to climb, but there's barbed wire across the top. More scrapes, more cuts, but she'll deal with that. She's sure any injuries will heal before she's unwound. Out of breath and near the end of her stamina, she hurls herself at the fence, but just before she reaches it, she's hit by someone even faster than she is, who takes her down, tackling her to the wet ground. She catches only a glimpse of his face, but it's enough to know who it is. The golden child himself has come to capture her.
"Get off me!"
she says, pushing Lev, scratching at him. She tears the platter from her chest and swings it. It connects with his head with a heavy bang. He falls, but he's right back up again.
"I swear I'll take your head off with this if I have to," she says. "Let me go. I don't care if they worship you. I don't care if you're their patron saint. I'm leaving and you can't stop me."
Then Lev backs off, breathing heavily, and says,
"Take me with you."
It's not what she expected to hear.
"What? I can't be a part of this anymore. I can't be what they want me to be. I'm no one's patron saint, and they can rescue Tithe fine without me, so I'm getting out too."
Miracolina doesn't have the time to figure out whether this is a trick. She doesn't even have the time to process what he's saying. But if he's telling the truth, she can test his resolve.
"Give me a boost up the fence."
He does it without hesitation. He helps her up, and she scratches herself on the barbed wire coming down the other side, but at least she's on the other side. Then Lev, the boy who she saw as her jailer, climbs over and joins her.
"There's a road,"
he says.
"Maybe 100 yards or so through the woods. We can flag down a ride." "Who would be driving on a night like tonight?" "There's always someone desperate to go somewhere."
The wind dies down a bit by the time they reach the road, but in tornado weather, that could be a good sign or bad. They haven't seen hail yet, and hail's a sure sign that something worse is on the way. Sure enough, there's traffic on the 2-lane road. Not much, just a car every minute or two, but all they need is one.
"They won't know we've gone until after the storm passes," Lev says. "If someone picks us up, promise me you won't tell them about the mansion and what we're doing there." "I won't promise anything,"
Miracolina tells him.
"Please," Lev begs her. "The other kids there aren't like you. They don't want to be tithed. Don't condemn them to something that was never their choice."
Although it goes against her instincts, right now the line between right and wrong is blurry enough for her to say,
"Fine, I won't tell."
"We'll make up a story," Lev says.
"We were out biking and got caught in a storm. Just go along with anything I say. Then when we're dropped off, if you really want to be tithed, go turn yourself in. I won't stop you."
And although she doubts he'll make it that easy, she agrees.
"What about you? Where will you go?"
"I have no idea," he tells her, and there is such a spark in his eye when he says it, she can tell having no idea is exactly the way he wants it. Headlights approach, and the wind picks up again. They wave their arms, and the vehicle, a van, pulls over to the side of the road. A window rolls down, and they hurry to the van.
"My God, what are you two doing out here in this?"
says the driver.
"We were on our bikes. We didn't know a storm was coming,"
Lev says.
"Where are the bikes?"
"We left them way back,"
Miracolina chimes in.
"We'll come get them after the storm," Lev says. "There's a tornado watch. We just need to get out of here. Can you help us?"
"Of course I can."
He unlocks the car, and Lev pulls open the side door. As he does, the dome light comes on, illuminating the man's face for the first time. Although the moment calls, quite literally, for any port in a storm, Miracolina can't help but be a bit troubled by the man's face as she gets in. There's something odd about it. Or maybe it's just his eyes. 34. Lev. Lev doesn't pay much attention to the driver. He's just glad to be out of the storm and to have transportation away from his gilded cage. He has lied to Miracolina. He has no intention of letting her turn herself in to the juvenile authority. He knows he might not be able to stop her, but that doesn't mean he can't try. A gust of wind almost pushes the van off the road as they drive, and the driver fights it with both hands on the wheel.
"Some storm, huh?"
the man says as he glances at Lev in the rearview mirror. Lev averts his gaze. The last thing he wants is to be recognized as that clapper kid.
"Comfy back there?"
the man asks. He hasn't asked them where they're headed yet. Lev runs through his mind the names of towns he knows in the area for when the question is inevitably asked. Outside, the rain slices at the windshield at such a violent angle. The wipers are defeated, and they have to pull over. The man turns to them.
Tornado watch, you say? Do you suppose we'll be taken to Oz?
He seems far too jovial under the circumstances.
The sooner we all get home, the better,
Miracolina offers.
Yes, but you're not headed home,
he says, the same happy tone to his voice.
We all know that, don't we?
Miracolina throws Lev a worried glance. The man has locked his gaze on Lev, and only now does Lev see how very mismatched his eyes are. The sight gives him a chill that has nothing to do with the storm.
I know you don't remember me, Mr. Calder, because you were unconscious at our last encounter, but I certainly remember you.
Lev reaches for the van door, but it's locked, with no visible way to unlock it.
Lev!
Shouts Miracolina, and when he looks back, he sees the man has pulled out a tranq pistol, which looks extremely large and nasty in such close quarters. Heavy hail begins to pummel the van, and the man must shout to be heard over it.
The first time I shot you, it was an accident,
he says.
This time, it's not.
Then he tranks both of them before they can say a word. Lev catches sight of Miracolina's eyes rolling back, and her slumping in the seat before he begins to drown in his own tranquilizer cocktail, spinning down, 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 while outside the sound of hail gives way to a roar like a freight train barreling through hell. 35. Nelson. In a flash of lightning, he sees a glimpse of the tornado. It tears out trees from the side of the road not 100 yards ahead of him. It tears up the road itself, chunks of asphalt flying into the sky. Something, a piece of road or a tree limb, puts a dent in the roof like the angry stomp of a giant. A side window shatters, and the van is dragged sideways from the shoulder and into the middle of the road. Nelson feels no fear, only awe. The van begins to lean to the left. He feels the entire vehicle straining in a tug-of-war between the wind and gravity. Finally, gravity wins, and the car remains a heavy, earthbound object instead of a 2-ton airborne projectile. Then, in a moment, the tornado is gone, tearing a jagged line towards someone else's misery. The roar fades, and it's just a torrential downpour once more. This, Nelson knows, is his second great defining moment. The first was the tranq bullet that stole his life. But now his life has been spared. Not just spared, but validated, all in the same moment. The capture of Lev Calder is no accident. Nelson has never believed in divine providence, but he is open to the idea of balance, that there is somehow justice in the grand scheme of things. If that's true, then justice will be visiting him very soon, delivering Connor Lassiter into his waiting hands. Part 5. Matters of Necessity. From The Independent, a UK news journal. Hoodies, Louts, Scum. How Media Demonizes Teenagers. By Richard Garner, Education Editor, Friday 13th, March 2009. The portrayal of teenage boys as yobs in the media has made the boys wary of other teenagers, according to new research. Figures show more than half of the stories about teenage boys in national and regional newspapers in the past year, 4,374 out of 8,629, were about crime. The word most commonly used to describe them was yobs, 591 times, followed by thugs, 254 times, sick, 119 times, and feral, 96 times. Other terms often used included hoodie, louts, heartless, evil, frightening, scum, monsters, inhuman, and threatening. The research, commissioned by Women in Journalism, showed the best chance a teenager had of receiving sympathetic coverage was if they died.
We found some news coverage where teen boys were described in glowing terms. Model student, angel, altar boy, or every mother's perfect son,
the research concluded.
But sadly, these were reserved for teenage boys who met a violent and untimely death.
The full article can be found at http://www.independent.co.uk/news/uk/home-news/hoodies/louts/scum-how-media-demonizes-teenagers-164396.html. 36. Connor. Connor takes out his aggression on the punching bag at least twice a day. He has to. If he doesn't, he might take it out on someone's face. The lazy kid who won't clean the latrines. The moronic girl who smuggled in a cell phone so she could call her friends and tell them where she is. And the kid who makes jokes after every clapper bombing. Connor hits the bag so hard and so much, it's a wonder the thing doesn't burst. Risa is gone. It's been almost a month now. For all he knows, she's dead at the hands of the juvenile authority, or proactive citizenry, or whoever has their clutches on her. It doesn't matter that she's 17 and disabled, unable to be unwound. The all-seeing government can be very nearsighted when it comes to scrutinizing the actions of its own appendages. Connor is not the same as he was. He feels his old patterns and habits returning. The same ones that earned him an unwind order to begin with. He thinks back to the days before he was AWOL, when he was just a problem kid. He's back in that place again, only now he's a problem kid responsible for hundreds of other problem kids. He can't help but think that it's not all him. His anger always seems to settle in Roland's hand.
"If you want out, no one would blame you,"
Starkey tells him over a game of pool one evening.
"You should go and try to find Risa. There are others who could take over this place. Trace could do it. Even Ashley or Hayden."
He leaves himself out far too conspicuously.
"Maybe we could put it to a vote once you're gone. Make the whole thing democratic."
"And you're already guaranteed at least a quarter of the vote, aren't you?" says Connor, charging through the bush Starkey keeps beating around. Starkey doesn't break his gaze, nor does he deny it.
"I could run this place, if I had to."
Then he sinks the eight ball too soon and loses the game.
"Damn, you win again."
Connor takes a good look at Starkey, who from the beginning always appeared straightforward and honest. But then, so did Trace. Only now does Connor begin to suspect that Starkey's motives might be more like designs. "You're good at getting food on the table, and you gave the storks some self-respect," Connor tells Starkey. "But don't think that makes you God's gift to unwinds."
"No," says Starkey. "I guess that spot's reserved for you."
Then he puts down his cue stick and leaves. Connor mentally smacks himself for being so paranoid. The truth is, he might actually want to groom Starkey to replace him someday. But who is he to be grooming anybody for anything? Used to be he could share his private insecurities with Risa. She was good at shoring him up by putting band-aids on his questionable sense of character long enough for him to heal and get the job done. He could try to confide in Hayden, but Hayden makes a joke out of everything. Connor knows it's a defense mechanism, but still it makes it hard to talk to him about some things. Now his only real confidant is Trace. Connor hates that Trace remains his closest ally, even after revealing himself as a traitor to both sides. But if Risa was a band-aid, then Trace is alcohol on an open wound.
"We've all lost people one way or another, and Risa's no different. So stop your belly aching and do your job."
"I'm not a buff," Connor tells him. "I wasn't trained to have no feelings."
"It's not that we don't have feelings. We just know how to harness them and direct them towards specific goals."
Which Connor might be able to do if he had a goal. But life at the graveyard feels more and more directionless. A treadmill that hurls kids off when they turn 17. Someone, Connor suspects it's Hayden, alerts the Admiral that he's not taking Reese's capture well, so the Admiral pays a surprise visit. He arrives at the graveyard in a black limo, waxed to such a smooth sheen it doesn't collect the dust it kicks up. Connor barely recognizes him when he steps out. The Admiral's thin,
not just thin but gaunt. His skin, once bronzed from his years in the graveyard sun, has gotten pale, and he's dressed not in his metal-covered uniform, but in slacks and a plaid shirt, like he's out for a round of golf. He still stands tall, though, and has the unmistakable bearing of a commanding officer. Connor expects the Admiral will tear him a new one, giving him a reprimand more severe than he himself gave Starkey. But as always, the Admiral's strategy cannot be predicted.
"You've put on some muscle since I last saw you," the Admiral tells him. "I hope to God you're not shooting up those damn military steroids they have the buffs on. They shrink your testicles down to peanuts."
"No, sir."
"Good, because your genes might actually be worth passing on."
He invites Connor to join him in his plush, air-conditioned limo, and they sit idling on the runway like the thing could sprout wings and take off at any given moment. They make small talk just a bit. The Admiral tells him of the great Harlan reunion, a huge party with all the people who had received his son's parts.
"I'll swear till the day I die that Harlan was there, alive in that garden, and no one can prove he wasn't."
He tells Connor how, when all the parts went their separate ways, Emby, his asthmatic friend, had nowhere to go, so the Admiral kept him on and is now raising him like a grandson.
"Not the shiniest Easter egg on the lawn," the Admiral says, "but he's very sincere."
He also tells Connor that due to his damaged heart, the Admiral was given 6 months to live.
"Of course, that was almost a year ago. Doctors are mostly imbeciles."
Connor suspects that the Admiral will be alive and kicking for years to come. Finally, he gets down to the real reason for his visit.
"I hear that this thing with Risa is getting to you,"
the Admiral says, then holds his silence, knowing Connor will eventually feel compelled to break it, which he does.
"What do you want me to do, huh? Just go on like it never happened? Like she never existed?"
The Admiral holds a steady demeanor, in spite of Connor's frustration.
"I hadn't pegged you as the kind of young man who wastes his time feeling sorry for himself."
"I'm not feeling sorry. I'm angry."
"Anger is only our friend when we know its caliber and how to aim it."
That makes Connor give out a sudden guffaw that's loud enough for the driver to glance back.
"Ha! Good one! Someone ought to quote you."
"Someone did. It's on page 93 of the Military Academy Freshman Ordnance Manual, 5th edition.
The Admiral turns to look out of the tinted windows at the activity of the graveyard.
"The problem with all you AWOLs is that you use your anger like a grenade, half the time blowing off your own hands."
Then he looks at Connor's arm.
"No offense."
"None taken." But now that the Admiral's attention has been drawn to the arm, he looks at it more closely.
"Do I know that tattoo?"
Then he snaps his fingers.
"Roland? Wasn't that his name? A real pain in the ass."
"That's the one." The Admiral ponders the shark a moment more.
"I don't suppose it was your choice to get his arm."
"It wasn't my choice to get any unwound arm," Connor tells him.
"If I had a choice, I would have refused it, the same way you refused an unwound heart, the same way Risa refused a new spine."
Connor feels goosebumps rise on the arm from the near Arctic chill of the air conditioner.
"But now I've got it. It's not like I'm going to hack it off."
"And well, you should keep it," the Admiral says. "Roland may have been a miscreant, but he was a human miscreant and deserved better. I'm sure he'd be satisfied to know that his arm is ruling the graveyard with an iron fist."
Connor has to laugh. Leave it to the Admiral to make sense of the senseless. Then the man gets quiet, serious.
"Listen here," he says. "This business about Risa, for everyone's sake, you've got to let it go."
But there are some things Connor just can't let go.
"I should never have let her make that trip to the hospital."
"If she hadn't, from what I understand, an innocent boy would have been unwound."
"So? Let him be unwound."
The Admiral quietly bristles.
"I'm going to forget you said that."
Connor sighs. You should never put me in charge. You wanted the Akron AWOL running this place, but he doesn't exist. He never did. He's just a legend.
I stand behind my decision. You see yourself as failing, but that's not what I see. Sure, when you're in the midst of your own suffering, it's easy to convince yourself that you're no good. But we are all tested in this life, Connor. The measure of a man is not how much he suffers in the test, but how he comes out at the end.
Connor lets his words sink in, wondering when this particular test will be over, and how many undiscovered layers it might still have. It makes him think about all the things Trace has told him. Admiral, have you heard of something called proactive citizenry? The Admiral thinks about it.
Sounds somewhat familiar. Don't they fund some of those blasted pro-unwinding advertisements?
He shakes his head in disgust.
They remind me of the old Terra Generation ads.
That catches Connor like a barbed hook. Terra Generation.
You know, the teen uprisings, the feral flash riots.
I'm drawing a total blank.
The Admiral looks at him like he's an idiot.
Good God, don't they teach you anything in those poor excuses for schools anymore?
Then he calms down, but only a little.
No, I suppose they wouldn't. History is written by the victors, and when there are no victors, it all winds up in corporate shredders.
He looks out the window with the sad resignation of a man who knows he's too old to change the world.
You must educate yourself, Mr. Lassiter, he says. They may not teach it, but they can't blot it out entirely. It's the very reason why people were so willing to accept the Unwind Accord, the very reason for our twisted way of life.
Sorry to be so ignorant, Connor says.
Don't be sorry, just do something about it. And if you're curious about this proactive citizenry, educate yourself on that, too. What is it you've heard about them?
Connor considers telling him everything he learned from Trace, but realizes it couldn't be good for the man's heart. The Admiral is retired, and while he can be called on to give Connor a swift and necessary boot, it would be wrong of Connor to involve him in things now.
Nothing,
Connor tells him. Rumors.
Then leave it to those who have nothing better to do than gossip, the Admiral tells him. Now man up! Get the hell out of my limo and save these kids' lives!
Once the Admiral is gone, Trace respectfully requests a private meeting with Connor. In spite of his admission that he's working for the Juvies and proactive citizenry, he still treats Connor with the full respect of a commanding officer. Connor doesn't know what to make of this. He can't tell whether it's a scam or if Trace is being sincere. Although Connor can't stomach being a pawn for the Juvies by maintaining their vault of unwinds, he can't deny that receiving privileged information from Trace makes him feel that he's the one pulling the wool over the eyes of the juvenile authority, and not the other way around. The truth hasn't set Connor free, as Trace has suggested, but at least it has given him a sense of power over his captors. They ride down one of the eastern aisles, past rows of fighter jets so dusty the cockpit windows don't even look like glass. They're far enough away from any activity in the graveyard that their meeting is very private.
You need to know that things are brewing, Trace tells him.
What kinds of things?
From what intelligence I've been able to gather, there's dissent in the juvenile authority. There's some who want to take this place out. They just need a reason.
If they want to take us out, the fact that we're here is reason enough.
I said some want to take us out. The suits I work for don't, and as long as everything stays smooth here, they can keep the Juvies muzzled. I've been a good little stool pigeon and continue to tell them that Elvis Robert Mullard is running a tight ship.
Connor laughs.
Ha! They still have no clue that Elvis has left the building?
None whatsoever, and I've given them no reason to doubt my word.
Trace pauses for a moment.
Did you tell the Admiral about me?
No, Connor tells him. I haven't told anyone.
Good. A leader should know things no one else does, and spoon out information on a need-to-know basis.
Spare me the military classroom, Connor tells him. So is that all you wanted to talk about?
There's more.
They reach the end of the aisle, and Trace stops before turning into the next one. He pulls out a slip of paper from his pocket and hands it to Connor. There's a name on it, scrawled by hand. Jansen Reinschild.
Is this someone I'm supposed to know? Connor asks.
No, he's someone nobody's supposed to know.
Connor has little patience for this. Don't waste my time with riddles,